My name is Sevgi Aral. I work in the STD Prevention Division at the Centers for Disease Control. I am going to moderate this mini plenary session, which is called Emerging Scientific Paradigms. We've got three fantastic speakers lined up for today. Our first presentation is titled Program Science. And our first speaker is Dr. David Wilson. He comes to us from the World Bank, where he heads up the global HIV/AIDS program for the World Bank. David, I have known David for over 25 years, since the late 80s, we figured out. He has been doing all kinds of things. But he, as a person, actually represents what he's going to talk about, program science. He has done programs, he has done science. He has over 100 scientific publications in the literature, and he has put together prevention programs in over 50 countries all over the world. So he knows both sides of this coin. He is a brilliant program expert, he's a brilliant scientist, and he's a brilliant speaker. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. David Wilson.
Thank you, Sevgi. This is rather a mouthful. It's the subject of my talk. As you know, UNAIDS have challenged us to get to zero infections by 2015, which they define as a 50% reduction in HIV incidence through sexual transmission. How are we going to get there? The challenge isn't helped by this look at the growing financing gap. Last year, for the first time, HIV disbursements fell by 10%, and UNAIDS still project that we have only half the resources we need to get to zero. So getting to zero is going to mean many things, including making better use of the resources we have. And I think program science has a key role in helping us to make better use of the resources we have. And here's a simple practical definition of program science: the systematic application of science to improve the design, the execution, and the evaluation of programs. Why is it important? I think a consistent theme in this conference so far has been the need to close the gap between science and programs, the need to address complex public health choices and difficult trade-offs. Trade-offs involving geographic foci, priority groups, intervention mixes, delivery mechanisms, and the need for real-time monitoring and the need for constant tactical and strategic adaptations in response to real-time data. And then finally, a theme we hear throughout this meeting, the importance of transdisciplinary approaches. STI-HIV prevention is about epi and public health, but it's also about management, it's about social science, and it's about the political economy of decision making. And so our aim is to change the Venn diagrams from the top one, where we are now, with small overlaps between program and science, to the second one, where program and science are interdigitated. It's a model, if you wish, of the embedded scientist, the reflective practitioner, integrated program and science. Now, what do science and program science have to do with HIV prevention? And I think this summary neatly distinguishes between new discovery and program science. And the first two, new technologies, efficacy evaluation, are core basic science. But the three boxed in red, building knowledge about what creates and sustains epidemics and where to direct our prevention efforts, optimizing execution, and evaluating impact and cost effectiveness are squarely the domain of program science. And here is one way of conceptualizing the components of program science, beginning with program intelligence, local epidemic intelligence, understanding transmission dynamics, and defining the major sources of transmission so that our programs can respond to the new infections that we need to prevent. Program implementation, developing scalable models that we can take and expand, developing standard operating procedures and QA systems so that we can deliver good sexual health interventions of the consistency of a Starbucks coffee, and program evaluation, so that we can monitor implementation in real time, as the private sector do. They know our consumer behavior, they know when we use our phones, they know how to target us. In response, public health is not as nimble as using real-time information for real-time decision-making. But also, a greater focus on population-level impact. We know what's efficacious under ideal circumstances. We need a better understanding of what works at the population level, and that's the domain of program science. Let me tackle a few frequently asked questions about program science. First, how is it different from implementation science? What implementation science is about is taking a single proven intervention and scaling it. It's how we implement better. But program science is concerned with the totality of a program, with overall program intelligence, with choices, with alternatives, and with trade-offs. And let's take a simple example of an implementation science approach and contrast it with a program science approach. Take the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. An implementation science question is, how do we do it more efficiently? A program science question is, what's the best way to prevent mother-to-child transmission? And many of you may have heard Ward Cates citing the great Ugandan study, which shows that we can prevent more cases of vertical transmission through good family planning programs than we can through the delivery of drugs to infected mothers. And Jamie Blanchard in the audience has shown the Indian government. The best and most cost-effective way of preventing mother-to-child transmission is stopping sex workers from infecting clients who then infect their spouses. Program science asks, what's the totality of what we're trying to achieve, and how can we best achieve it? Second FAQ, how does program science differ from operations research? Operations research is great. It asks, how do we optimize a particular intervention? So if we're interested in making VCT more accessible, operations research would be the feasibility of mobile test centers, the feasibility of home-based testing, the feasibility of distributing kits through pharmacies. But program research asks the bigger question about what we're doing relative to everything else we could be doing. And it focuses on population-level impact. Finally, program science and the increasingly common phrase translational research. Translational research is designed to answer one question. Once we have evidence, how do we get the evidence into practice? It tends to focus on single interventions, and by definition, it's unidirectional. How do we take the science and put it into the program? But program science is multidirectional, it's bidirectional, and it focuses on multiple interventions and their interfaces. It also derives hypotheses from programs, from practice. Let's briefly trace the history of the Program Science Initiative, which began in June 2007 with an initial advisory group meeting, led to the development of the first publication on the concept in STIs, was embedded in major conferences, and then led to the initiation of some major program science initiatives at country levels, in countries as diverse as India, Kenya, Nigeria, Brazil, the Ukraine. And then this meeting marks a further milestone in program science. It's been spearheaded very much by a partnership between CDC and SEVGI in the front row and University of Manitoba, Jamie sitting in the fourth row, supported by the institutions whose members you see on the right. And let's just look at how we're now starting to put it into country-level initiatives. And I'm taking examples here from India, from Pakistan, from Kenya, from Nigeria, from Brazil, with a further 10 countries joining a program science initiative this year. We've done a lot on program intelligence, epidemic surveillance, mapping and size estimation, whether of sex workers in Nigeria, and I'll show you examples of vulnerable groups in Pakistan shortly. Understanding transmission dynamics so we know where our last 1,000 infections are coming from and how best to tackle them. A real focus on program implementation, developing scalable models, which is something that, for example, China lacks. Its typical program has 2 CDC officers for a county of 3 million people. They recruit 4 former drug users and 6 former sex workers, and that's the extent of the model and the outreach. It cannot go further. In contrast, India has developed scalable models through micro-planning, through the development of structured behavioral interventions, and through rigorous real-time monitoring. We also need strong support chains to ensure quality. And as I've stressed before, we need program monitoring and evaluation. If I could borrow a beautiful phrase from our third speaker, David Peters, if we have a separate component called monitoring and evaluation, we failed. It has to be so integral to everything we do that it doesn't have its own box. It guides everything we do. This slightly busy wheel represents the World Bank's conceptual framework in HIV and health. And it focuses on, in the top quadrant, improving what we call allocative efficiency, slicing and allocating the pie more wisely, by strengthening epidemic intelligence, by strengthening surveillance, by mapping, by good syntheses of data, by better planning, so that we allocate scarce resources optimally by geographic area, by target group, by disease priority, and by intervention. And we've done a lot on improving allocative efficiency, but there's still a long way to go, as I'll show in examples. Second, a neglected area, except I think for the remarkable work that PEPFAR has done in treatment optimization and work that Gates and others are now leading in the E-squared initiative. But this means how can we deliver the same service at the same quality for less cost? And there are a whole host of tools we can use here. Moving on to what we all are familiar with, effectiveness, which we are defining in the program science initiative, not as efficacy, that is, impact under ideal circumstances, but population-level effectiveness in the real world. Messy, complex evaluation. And then finally, something that we've been able to neglect globally until recently, sustainability. But as we know, and as I'll show in this talk, it's now urgent. I'd just like to take the components of program science and link them to the wheel to show we're talking about the same things, whether from the epidemiological lens of program science or the economic lens of the World Bank. And program intelligence guides allocative efficiency. It's about the intelligence to allocate optimally. Program implementation is concerned with technical efficiency, delivering the same service at the same quality for progressively less cost. And program evaluation and effectiveness are synonymous. With those introductory remarks on the concepts behind program science, I'd like to just take a few applications. And I'm sorry if you can't read this entire graph. It's a NASA, National Spending Account for Lesotho's AIDS program in 2010. If you can see here, you'll see a gigantic anomaly. VCT is almost 50% of the prevention spend, despite evidence it's a great gateway to treatment, it's not necessarily an optimal intervention on its own. PMTCT is 26%, vital but doesn't change the course of the adult epidemic by one case. Male circumcision in Lesotho, one of the 5 highest prevalence countries in the world, low male circumcision rates, less than 2% of the budget spent on male circumcision. You don't have to look long and hard at this to realize that allocative efficiency is not optimal. But let's turn it around and let's be positive and let's look at the gains that program science can make if we optimize intelligence to improve allocative efficiency. Take Pakistan, clearly a concentrated epidemic with the highest prevalence being injecting drug users followed by hijras or transgenders, then male sex workers, and very low rates in female sex workers and almost no prevalence in the general population. Now, Pakistan has a myriad of security and other challenges. Can program science make HIV prevention easy enough to do in a complex context? And I hope the next graphs will convince us it can. This is a really nice graph from Jamie Blanchard about the size of IDU populations in Pakistan, with the actual circles representing the actual size of populations. And the bottom line is if you just take four towns in a large and complex country, Karachi, Faisalabad, Lahore, Hyderabad, you're dealing with 70% of the injecting drug users in those four centers. That's a proposition that Pakistan, for all of its competing health priorities, can address. Similarly, female sex workers in Pakistan, 72% in just five cities and about 60% in two key cities, Lahore in the Punjab and Karachi in Sindh. That's where we need to focus to be really effective. And finally, transgenders, hijras, dominated by Karachi, but with almost two-thirds in Karachi and two other cities, Lahore and Multan. So my proposition here is program science, program intelligence, can turn a bewilderingly complex problem into something we can tackle decisively with a razor-sharp focus. Now, let's challenge ourselves. And this is what I call the allocative and technical efficiency conundrum that South Africa presents. South Africa is home to one in five people globally with HIV. This is how their HIV budget is spent. There are a couple of messages here. The obvious message, which we don't need to dwell on, is treatment is a big part of the costs. But the real message to me is how little room South Africa has to allocate its money better. We can't reduce treatment. We can't reduce PMTCT. We don't reduce VCT as a gateway to the previous two interventions. And we certainly don't want to reduce condoms. So we're left with about 4% of our budget to allocate. No scope for allocative efficiency there. What we have to do is push the technical efficiency frontier further. So we can do treatment, PMTCT, VCT, and even condoms for less, freeing up money to allocate to neglected areas. You don't even see male circumcision here. In the one country in the world where male circumcision would make the biggest difference. So allocative efficiency is great where you have glaring inefficiencies. Where you don't, and even where you don't, you need better technical efficiency. And this means understanding the overall unit costs. Look at this comparison of treatment costs in five African countries. But obviously South Africa will be more expensive. We need to understand the drivers of cost. And sure enough, they're personnel and drugs. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Wage costs in South Africa have to be higher than countries with a tenth of the per capita income. And the drugs may reflect South Africa's far more sophisticated second-line program. But we need to understand the sources of cost, the explanations behind them, and how we can reduce the costs and drive down the whole production chain. And here are some examples. A big opportunity everywhere, and here we look at data from several countries, is reducing idle staff time. Anyone who's been to clinics in Africa will know that they're bursting until about 10 in the morning and progressively emptier throughout the day. And we see this depicted here in the amount of unused staff time we have. But it's also about the staffing model. And just contrast four different models. Rwanda's, which is nurse-centered with a heavy reliance on roving doctors and a heavy use of community health workers. Malawi's, where clinical officers are surrogate doctors and admin clerks act as surrogate nursing assistants. Not an optimal model, and you can see that in the utilization. Ethiopia, in fact, the one here where there's least idle time, where costs are driven by nurses and pharmacists, but distorted somewhat by higher staffing in private facilities. And then Zambia, where we have a plurality of models, and we can actually test which is most efficient. Here's another nice example of how we can reduce unit costs. And sometimes we have too much plant. China, for example, has more CD4 machines than all of Africa. Entire counties in China with no HIV patients have installed CD4 machines. And even within Africa, we see the same challenge. Look at Malawi. The costs here are far higher because of overinvestment in CD4 machines. They've got a capacity to do 1.5 million tests. They're actually doing 180,000. So there's a tenfold overcapacity. But that's not wholly inexplicable. Transport and infrastructure are so poor, we can't make better use of existing machines. So I hope these examples illustrate some of the opportunities to better understand and improve our technical efficiency. I'd now like to move to effectiveness, which is squarely the domain of program science, especially population-level effectiveness. And what could be more population level than this graph from Jeff Garnett's team at Imperial, showing Zimbabwe, national population level impact in a complex country at a complex point in its history. What can we be sure of here? I think from the really nice modeling in the top quadrants, we can be very sure when incidence fell, and we see two significant periods of incidence decline. I also think from the quality of the behavioral research, we can be confident about what behaviors change. And the big factor was partner reduction. It's clear here. Changes in the others, abstinence or condom use, couldn't be detected. But what we cannot be sure about, and what has to be the domain of program science, is to what extent, if at all, did formal programs contribute to these changes in behavior which contribute to such steep incidence declines? That has to be the domain of program science. And just look at the looming challenge of sustainability. Only two countries in Africa, South Africa and Botswana, fund their own AIDS programs. And only South Africa is really prepared to go it alone in a context where they are one-fifth to one-fourth of the entire global AIDS epidemic. Elsewhere in Africa, we have countries such as Mozambique, 96% reliant on donor funding, Tanzania, 97%, and at the very top, Malawi, almost 98%. Sustainability, more robust, more diversified, more nationally owned programs has to be part of the program science domain. So in conclusion, why does program science matter so much? I think that it matters because if we look back globally, there's been insufficient effort to do some things we could have done. And those are to match our prevention priorities to transmission dynamics, so that we don't compromise prevention with mismatched or unfocused responses. As Jim Curran said really nicely at the satellite meeting yesterday, not everything has to be scaled up to the same level. You need to understand the rationale for scaling up different things. But also, we haven't aligned our interventions enough with our evidence, and we haven't focused enough on the most proven interventions. And if you need an example, reflect back to Lesotho's 2% allocation for male circumcision. And we have to, as I've tried to argue in the technical efficiency slides, focus more on increasing the efficiency of service delivery. So I think the reason program science matters so much is globally, we've been slow to implement proven approaches at real scale. And with the knowledge we already have, we can and should have done much better, and program science can help us to bridge this gap. Thank you.
David, thank you so very much. That was fantastic. By my watch, we have about 5 minutes. So if there are any comments and questions, please go to the mic. There are mics on in the two aisles in the room. Introduce yourselves and make your comment or ask your question. Dr. Cranston.
Yeah, Mr. Cranston.
Hi,
Dr. Wilson, thank you very much for a thrilling presentation. Very, very helpful and very enlightening, even in a number of current discussions and transformations in the U.S. system. I guess I'm asking for help as an administrator who often has sufficient inputs in terms of from the raw basic science or the program evaluation science about relative benefits, and can reasonably well describe where money is going, what are the general outputs from those services, and make some correlation between those and some program impacts. I'm stuck with a maximization problem, which is with a fixed amount of resource, not just what's the relative percentage, but also how those proportions of services. You made reference, for example, to how VCT is a feeder system into the treatment. And my understanding is, and my fear is, that most of the services that get funded in any area are so interactive that we can't ever get to the core benefit for funding this much here and this much there. Frankly, I'm lacking an analytic frame for really making definitive statements that I can justify the relative allocation and would benefit from a little more thinking or conversation about how to analyze the inputs that I do have.
That's a great question.
Go ahead.
I can take them in three seconds.
Okay. Mr. Wolfiler.
Hi, Dan Wolfiler, California Department of Public Health, and at the risk of bringing up the same question at almost every presentation, this was really interesting work, especially if we define what we do in health departments as service delivery. And I'm also wondering what program science or how you all have tackled the issue of addressing some of the social determinants with our policy levers, so that if we wanted to address, for example, what do we do about migrant workers in Africa, and what does that say what we have to do in terms of working with ministries of transport and work and labor? Similarly, in this country, what do we do with the correctional system in order to reduce much of the same effect? What resources can we, should we, have you thought about, how do we dedicate resources to addressing those issues, particularly from within our distinct categorical branches?
Thank you.
Let's take the third question as well.
Yeah. Alfred Chihata, MD, researcher in HIV and STD prevention for the last 20 years. My question to Dr. Wilson focuses on two points he mentioned: the delivery system and the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. And lastly, is the cost. I'm referring to the two research that being conducted in Africa. The CAPRISA study, which had showed that tenofovir, 1% gel, could prevent the HIV overall by 39%.
Yeah.
And for a better compliant women, even 54%.
Yeah.
While to our disappointment, VOICE study did not show any effectiveness at all for tenofovir, and they have to stop the study.
Yeah.
And if Dr. Wilson know first the cause, I think it is presumed it is the adherence of the second, because the CAPRISA study, women apply the tenofovir before and after intercourse. In VOICE study...
In the interest of time, can we wrap up the question?
Yeah, I will wrap it in 10 seconds. In VOICE study, they let women apply the gel every day. Could that be a reason? And then delivery system, if we can have a device, fit and forget, so would eliminate the compliance factors and maintain the gel for a prolonged time. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are all good questions, and let me answer them in a group. The first question, how we disentangle different elements of a program and how we actually try and assess which of the elements have been effective and which are needed for others. In short, the complexity, which David will talk about. I think it's a great point. I think that I would respond by saying that if we look at HIV among the priority populations in concentrated epidemic contexts, such as North America, sex workers, drug users, gay men, we do know which core interventions have the greatest impact. We know, for example, that needle exchange and harm reduction are the heart of IDU prevention, supported by opiate substitution therapy. We know some of the key interventions for gay men and sex workers. So I think for me, a partial criteria would be to what extent does the intervention serve the core prevention purpose that we're striving for. And if I could give an anonymous example from China, which made me somewhat despondent, a big new initiative in China focused on gay men, and it tried to promote access to testing and counseling. I saw that as a regressive endpoint, because 20 years ago, our aim was to ensure that gay men always used condoms in unprotected sex. And so my point is that's the core intervention we're still striving for, so let's look at how much it serves that purpose directly. There's no question that testing as a pathway to treatment is critical. I also think to make the better informed decisions that you're talking about, we need better costing. In general, we've been slow to adequately cost, at least in developing countries, I'm not sure about America, service delivery under a range of different models. And it's even harder, therefore, to assess cost effectiveness. And we're playing catch-up globally now. And just the simple cost data that we need to make good decisions. The second point about structural determinants, and can program science pay attention to structural determinants? And I think the answer is it really can. And the clearest examples we have come from concentrated epidemic contexts. And we can show in any context that if we're working in a context where we don't have structural and contextual support, where we're working against laws, policies, local practices, it's far harder to achieve coverage and it costs far more. So we can work around, but only with unsustainably high inputs. We can show in program science what an incredible economic, epidemiological, and effectiveness contribution the right structural and contextual factors have. So I like that question. Thank you for giving me a chance to highlight it. Now, the third is an excellent question. I don't know why CAPRISA worked and VOICE didn't yet. I think it's going to take a lot of time to disentangle that. We also have contradictory PrEP findings. I would emphasize that adherence is clearly critical. And from a program science lens, I would also emphasize the adherence levels we're seeing in efficacy trials where women receive intensive counseling and support are almost certainly going to be higher than the adherence levels we see in the real world of population level effectiveness, which is where I think program science is so important too. Thank you.
Thank you, David. That was terrific.